This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We're going to start with a couple bills by non-committee members. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1369 is an attempt for a couple of the facilities in Red Wing to consolidate services. And this is a program, a proposal that that the entities have been working on for more than a year now, and I believe that with the amendment that Mr. Gill has, that the department is comfortable with the way that the calculation is going to be made. But members, basically what's going on here is that Red Wing is trying to be consistent with the Communities for a Lifetime initiatives that were outlined in the Preparing for Minnesota for the Age Wave report that was done. A lot of the state initiatives, regarding downsizing the number of nursing home beds and the development of community-based long-term care options. And I really feel that what the representatives that are here with me today from Red Wing have proposed is it's an outstanding proposal, and it's going to help benefit our community. And above all else, it's going to help provide even better services for their clients. And with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm going to let Mr. Thompson, who's the CEO and president of Benedictine Healthcare Systems, speak next. And then Mike Schultz, a longtime friend of mine from Hyde Park and is the CEO up at Hyde Park, and he'd like to speak on behalf of St. Bridget's.
Thank you. Before we start with them, Senator Torres Ray moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the author's shape.
Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion? If not, all the Senator Hand.
I just wondering if I can get a copy of the bill.
It's not in your packet, the bill or the
Oh, amendment? The bill. I've got the amendment. I don't have the bill.
Okay, we'll get you one. Do you mind if we act on the author's amendment in the meantime? On the Torres Ray motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, that amendment was worked out between the gentlemen that are here at the table with me and the department. It just cleans up a little bit of the language in regards to the way that these payments are going to be made.
Good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dale Thompson. I'm the president and CEO of the Benedictine Health System. We have 60 long-term care facilities in 40 communities in six states in the upper Midwest, most of them in Minnesota, and we're based in Duluth. Appreciate the chance to just make a few brief comments about Senate File 1369. We're privileged to have been invited by the Fairview Red Wing Health System, Ebenezer, and other organizations in the community to collaborate on this effort. I would say to you something you all know, that finding the way forward with elder care in Minnesota is not an easy task today, and many communities struggle with it, and to find a way to do it without taking new money is even a more difficult task, and we believe that this proposal does all of the above. By my count, I think the 71st and 72nd nursing home in the state announced their closure with the key in the door, throw away the key, and it's very difficult to reduce the number of nursing home beds, even though we know it's the right thing to do, and to find new ways and options for elders to find care in the community. But it can be very painful. So to find a sane way to do it, one that meets the needs in the community, there's another bill floating around this body someplace on actually coming up with a certification for Communities for a Lifetime that would be an incredible milestone to set a template for communities to have a discussion about how to care for elders in new ways. So we're pleased to be a part of that. I think most nursing homes are closing because they're 40 to 50 years old and not able to upgrade. We have an exception to the moratorium process, but it only yields an interest payment, only part of your mortgage payment, so the process doesn't work. And so all taken all into consideration, this is a very exciting proposal. This proposal, my final comment would be, does find a way forward to bring the full continuum to the community. It aligns services with payment, and this is something that's hard for a lot of people to grasp, but the MSHO program, for example, it takes Medicare and Medicaid funds and pools them, and finally allows us to focus on the needs of an elder person, not the building, not the license, not all the things that we've been focused on in the past, to do the right thing is all part of this care collaboration care coordination systems. It calls for the elimination of two older, bigger nursing homes and the replacement of one smaller facility. And even after the cost of the new, and even after allowing for the cost of elderly waiver monies, Medicaid monies to place people in the community, it saves approximately $200,000 a year in total Medicaid savings, part of which is proposed to go back to the state. For those of you familiar with last year, there was a Communities for a Lifetime piece of legislation for Steele County in Owatonna, and it's very similar conceptually to that. So with those brief comments and the biggest of the big picture, I would stop at that point and defer to Mr. Schultz, who can talk more about the Red Wing community itself's view of this.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Schultz. I'm the CEO administrator at St. Bridget's at High Park in Red Wing, Minnesota. And for me, today is an exciting day because it's an opportunity of a lifetime. In our community, we have several healthcare facilities, and our gaps analysis shows that we have too many skilled nursing beds. And so we started to look at the Communities for a Lifetime as an opportunity to move forward and move in the direction that the state is asking us to move toward. And so what we did is we took a coordinating approach for senior care that we're calling fostering healthy seniors. And this bill is consistent with that Communities for a Lifetime and the transformation of 2010, preparing Minnesota for the age wave. We're taking a bill that would allow for the closure of two facilities, 149 skilled beds, and removal of 48 beds out of the system, and arising back with an 80-bed facility built on the campus of the local hospital. That it's an important step in furthering our fulfilling our mission of the vision of fostering healthy seniors in our community. And instead of moving from that institutional setting, but actually back into the community, community-based options, and reducing the cost to our that we need to take care of our elderly. The bill is revenue neutral and, in fact, returns money to the state because of the downsizing of beds. Because the state of Minnesota has a moratorium on the construction of new long-term care facilities, obviously our first step is to obtain legislative and or regulatory approvals for this new facility. The effort is not only to maintain, this effort will not only maintain jobs for employees at both Seminary Home and St. Bridget's, it will ensure jobs for our area residents for the future. Puts us at a state-of-the-art facility. I think what's unique for us is part of our community that is working together in the healthcare world is both Fairview Red Wing Health Services, Benedictine Health System, Ebenezer, a manager of assisted living and memory care, Fairview Partners, which will provide care coordination, and Goodhue County, which is as part of the management of the South Country Healthcare Alliance. So all of those points really lead us to say that this is an opportunity that we feel we should pursue vigorously. We may not get it again. It takes something to get it's like anything in life. To get somebody from across town that's in competition with you for 30 years and to say, we'll sit down and we'll say what makes sense for our community, we're willing to do that. We're willing to take that risk and to step forward and say to the state of Minnesota, we think we have found a way that will help prepare our community for the age wave. And Red Wing is an elderly community, obviously. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from members of the committee? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak with concerns about the bill? Center hand, questions or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just have a question. It's kind of technical in nature, but on page 3 of the bill, 3.13, refers to the property payment rate. And then it has a calculation, 316 to 330, roughly. Can you, someone, explain what the property rate, what that means, and then give some kind of a description of what this formula does?
Mr. Gill, you want to, or Dave wants to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn. Essentially, the rate-setting mechanisms for nursing homes, particularly for a new facility under the moratorium exception process, and in the past when the system was cost-based, segregated the rate into many components, one of which was the so-called property rate, from which one is supposed to be able to pay one's interest expense, upkeep to the facility, and so on. So when you ask a nursing home what its rate is, and if you ask them what its property rate is, that's that part of the Medicaid rate, equivalent then to the private pay rate in this state as well, that is your source of money to basically keep up your building, make your mortgage payments, and so on. So what has to happen is that a new property rate has to be calculated that will cover the cost of the new, smaller facility. And when you there's one of the handouts you have has the actual calculation as we see it. We're working with DHS now on the fiscal note. But those slides that show the arithmetic of it all basically show the calculation, the savings. So even if the property payment rate is raised to pay for the new mortgage, the savings overall, because 69 residents are not going to be cared for in nursing homes in the future, nets out to the savings.
And
kind
Mr.
of a long answer to a great short question. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you. That is clear. I can't say I would be able to describe what this formula does, but I kind of get the concept, I think. Who pays the rate? Is that what is the, I mean, who is the payer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, basically there are three payment sources in a nursing home. There is the Medicaid payment rate, which is paid by the State Department of Human Services, essentially. There is a private pay rate where people in nursing homes pay out of their own pocket, and then there is a Medicare service that's provided, and that's paid through an intermediary, but basically those are all federal dollars. Now, when the state calculates its Medicaid rate, the whole rate, the property rate, and so on, it affects sets the private pay rate. The nursing home cannot set its own private pay rates. And so that calculation that you're looking at needs to be as detailed as it is, because when the time comes, if this bill were to pass and the new facility were to be built and open, someone has to sit down and make the calculation. And so the reason it's so detailed is so everybody knows what the calculation is going to be, so you don't end up with a mortgage and then have it be some different calculation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? If not, Senator Lynch moves that Senate File 1369 as amended be recommended to pass. And this goes to Senator Berglund's division, I assume, and referred to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thanks. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and good luck with the exciting project.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lurie.
I make a motion we reconsider the motion by which Senate File 1478 was not recommended to pass a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. And that is a, I think that's a debatable motion.
Can we have an explanation of that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Lurie, maybe you could make a brief explanation.
This is the newborn screening program provisions that Senator Scheid carried a couple of weeks ago. There was prolonged debate regarding this bill. At the end of the day, it was defeated, I think, not because a majority of the committee did not believe that something needed to be done, but rather that the solution that was in front of us at the time was not ready to go. I know many people have been talking about it since, and I think it deserves reconsideration.
And I became aware of this about 2 hours ago, and I've talked with Senator Scheid, and she is supportive of this motion. It was her bill, obviously. She was supportive of this motion, but she could not be here, and she told me I could pass that on. So, Senator Corey.
Mr. Chairman, so then, Mr. Chairman, if the chair could tell us what hypothetically what would happen then if we reconsider it and we recommend that it pass, then it would just keep moving on through the process then, or?
Senator Corey, if the committee votes to reconsider it, the bill will be before us with a motion to recommend the bill pass and move to the Judiciary Committee. People could amend it. People can vote it down. That's the committee's decision. Mm-hmm. And if we pass Senator Lurie's motion, then it's in front of us as if mm-hmm. as if it's just up here the first time, the same mm-hmm. issue.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, do you know what the changes have been worked out?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, excuse me, long day. I've been told that there was some interest in trying that Senator Lynch had amendment, that she had a bill last year and was interested in that. But I don't know, I frankly don't recall the details of the bill from last year, and I don't know, but that's what I'm told there is. And again, the committee can vote down the amendment and can vote the bill out the way it is. They can pass the amendment. They can offer alternative amendments, or we can just defeat this motion if you don't support. Further discussion, Senator Cory.
Another question. So there's been some deals made. So then, is the policy committee going to hear what those deals are? Because if we just, okay, all right,
Senator Coring, I think it's appropriate you hear what the motion's about and what the bill is about, what any amendments are about. We had presentation on the bill, but obviously, I think you'd want to hear what Senator Lynch is proposing. If so, further discussion on the Lori motion,
Mr.
Senator Fischbach.
Just one other question. We've got the bill in front of us, but it doesn't have the co-authors, and since Senator Scheid can't be here, is one of the co-authors here?
These are the co-authors. Senator Scheid and Rosen are the co-authors. Senator Scheid's the author, so Senator Rosen's the co-author.
So, Mr. Chair, is it appropriate for us to?
I think we can. I think it would be better if we try and hunt down one of the two of them. So, Senator Lori, why don't we
withdraw the motion
and see if we can get one of the authors
somebody,
here.
Get them in the room, and I'll renew my motion.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then we've got Senate File 1799, Senator Torres-Ray. And, again, members, on that motion, I learned about this about 2 hours ago, and so we did put it in the notice here on the agenda, and I think we sent out notice of it as well. But it was very short notice to people. But, again, members, it doesn't have to be noticed if people want to reconsider previous motions. I think the one thing is if a bill is bill is in our hands as long as it's been voted down. So, Senator Torres-Ray, Senate File 1799.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present this important issue before you. Senate File 1799 proposes to address a very important issue and to give the state of Minnesota an opportunity to develop a comprehensive strategy to deal with Alzheimer's disease. Many states in the country are now putting together, have in place a system that they have worked out with many experts to deal with this disease and the growing need that these communities have. Minnesota is in need of a comprehensive state strategy to address the needs of persons with Alzheimer's disease and all related disorders. This bill will provide a mechanism to consider all of the issues that are affecting this growing population. Right now, we have about 5,000 individuals who are struggling with this disease. And in this bill, Mr. Chairman, and maybe before I move with the testimony, I need to ask for your support in including an amendment, moving an amendment for this bill. And it's before you, the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair. And although it seems very complicated, it really isn't. It's just that the same word is mentioned in several places in the bill. So when I move it in one place, I have to move it throughout. I have to change it throughout the bill. So I'm going to explain what it is, Mr. Chairman. And basically what it is that we are deleting the Commissioner of Health, and instead we are introducing the Minnesota Board on Aging. So the Minnesota Board on Aging will be assuming this responsibility. So in every place where you see Commissioner of Health, you will be now seeing Minnesota Board of Aging, and this is what the amendment intends to do. And also that we are changing the composition of the group to include 20 members because we have heard that many organizations that are not listed here are very interested in being part of this group and working on this effort. So those are the changes that I'm proposing with the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray moves A1 amendment. You want to delete the Commissioner of Health?
No, Mr. Chairman. Sorry.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape she wants. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. To clarify, Mr. Chairman, the Commissioner of Health will be part of this group. It's just that they are not going to be taking the lead on this effort.
I understand.
And to explain the need for this effort and some statistics, and I have a couple of individuals. I have Mary Bircher with me, who is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association, and Mr. Rayleigh McCartan, who is a neurologist and medical director of the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourselves for the record.
Sure. Thank you. I'm Mary Bircher, the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, and members of the committee. By the middle of this century, more than 14 million Americans will have Alzheimer's disease, 10 million baby boomers. Today in Minnesota, nearly 100,000 persons are living with Alzheimer's, and over 175,000 caregivers are providing 150 million hours of unpaid care. We put the cost of that unpaid care at $1.6 billion for the state of Minnesota. New figures announced by the Alzheimer's Association last week place Alzheimer's disease as the sixth leading cause of death in America and estimates new cases will be diagnosed every 70 seconds. Alzheimer's disease is truly the public health threat of the 21st century. Yet most states, including Minnesota, have no comprehensive plan for dealing with the expected tripling of persons with Alzheimer's disease in the future. Senate File 1799 calls for the creation of an Alzheimer's disease working group to study and make recommendations that could help us confront the enormous challenges ahead by bringing together private and government stakeholders and bringing them to the table, collectively analyzing the needs of people with Alzheimer's disease, and developing recommendations that will prioritize and drive state policy over the next 5 to 10 years. We require an infrastructure that will provide for dementia-capable programs for the growing numbers of people impacted by dementia. This bill provides a mechanism to examine the range of issues, including support systems during all stages of the disease, establishment of a surveillance system to determine the size and characteristics of the changing population with dementia, and the state's role in long-term care, family caregiver support, earlier diagnosis and interventions. Now is the time for states to prepare to address the multiple and complex challenges Alzheimer's poses to individuals, families, communities, and state governments. Greater collaboration between the Board on Aging, the Alzheimer's Association, and stakeholders listed in the bill are critical if we are to obtain the outcomes, the dementia-capable outcomes that are needed until a cure is found or prevention is possible. Despite the soaring human and financial crises and costs, the federal government has failed to treat Alzheimer's disease as the crisis, the pending crisis that it is. We have been fortunate in Minnesota to work with the Board on Aging to pilot several successful initiatives on dementia identification and family memory care. But it is not enough. We need many more partners at the table if we are to serve our families and our communities well as we struggle with this terrible disease. We have the will to carry our vision for a competent, dementia-competent state forward, and we're now asking for your leadership. We need awareness to be raised, stigmas need to be buried, physicians and primary care systems need to be engaged, and families need to be supported. It is our hope that the establishment of an Alzheimer's working group will address the coming tsunami with a thoughtful, integrated, and cost-effective approach for Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, Ms. Richard. Doctor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, and thank you for this opportunity. Our goal as healthcare providers is to improve quality of life and reduce healthcare costs. Improving quality of life is why people go into healthcare. Reducing costs is no longer just a good idea, it's an absolute necessity. Alzheimer's disease is a chronic progressive disease associated with predictable problems. Unfortunately, many families don't realize they're dealing with Alzheimer's disease. And so their only recourse is to wait till there's a crisis, bring mom into the emergency room, mom gets admitted to the hospital, she's treated for a urinary tract infection or dehydration, she's sent home again, the cycle repeats a few times, and then mom ends up in a nursing home. This is not only a dreadful waste of resources, it's a dreadful quality of life for patients and families, and we can do better. Now, because of the way people typically think of disease, which is an acute care model, when they're told they have a disease, their question is, what's the treatment? And that usually translates into, what pill do I take or what procedure do I have? And sometimes they're told, well, Alzheimer's disease, that's untreatable. It's not untreatable. Like many chronic diseases, Alzheimer's disease is incurable, but there are absolutely interventions that will make life better, and usually those interventions deal with education, planning, and changes in lifestyle. That may not be what people want to hear. That's what they have to do. With Alzheimer's disease, a very important part of that is learning to communicate with somebody who has Alzheimer's disease. Families have to learn it. Other healthcare providers, people dealing with the patient, have to learn to communicate better. There are a lot of bad outcomes in Alzheimer's disease, and it may be that somebody mismanages their medications. They screw up their finances. They have a car accident. They have access to firearms. They leave the stove on. But the most common bad outcome is that they become socially isolated. And a lot of times it's an old man and his wife, and they're pretty much cut off from the rest of the world because they don't know what they're dealing with, and nobody's told them what they're dealing with. Now think of it. Think of another disorder where there are cognitive and behavior problems. Say you had a family member that had bipolar disease or substance abuse. If you don't recognize that and you don't know how to deal with it, it's going to destroy your family. We want to keep families together. That's the only way to deal with this epidemic that's coming. I've been working in dementia clinics for 25 years, and I will tell you that the vast majority of people with Alzheimer's disease that live in the community, you can't spot them. You could bump into them out in the hallway, have a conversation with them, and you're not going to know it. The changes are subtle. They come on insidiously. Patients often don't recognize them, and patients' families and their providers often don't want to know about it. So they ignore the problems. You can ignore these problems, but they'll get your attention, and usually it's in that crisis mode. And you end up in the emergency room, the hospital, you're spending tens of thousands of dollars. What we would recommend is identify these problems early, when they're mild, when they're not serious, and when you can make some plans to avoid the expensive outcomes that will inevitably come. If I could have 2 minutes, I'll tell you about a project that we're doing. I work mostly at the Veterans Hospital, and the VA in the Upper Midwest is quite progressive in chronic disease management, and we have developed what's called the Dementia Demonstration Project. We train teams in how to screen for, diagnose, and manage dementia, specifically Alzheimer's disease. We have a sample of clinics. In primary care clinics, we capture about 25% of older veterans in the Upper Midwest. Anybody who's 70 and older who does not already have a diagnosis of dementia gets screened. We've screened over 7,000 patients. 99% of people agree to the screen. 40% of them agree to further evaluation on the first pass, and we pick them up because we keep following them. And then nurses continue to manage them. 25% of the people fail the screen, and of those that get a further evaluation, 93% of them are impaired. These are huge numbers. I mean, we've picked up hundreds of people that nobody has ever told they have dementia. And we have preliminary data. We hope to have better data, but we think we're keeping people out of the emergency room and out of the hospital. And that's where the cost is. And we hope eventually by having them teaching caregivers how to deal with them, we'll keep them out of nursing homes also. So I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Doctor. Questions from the committee? Senator Bretner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Reyes, it seems to me there's one glaring missing element on your board. And I think that a psychologist should be on there, since a psychologist is the only one that can really make the diagnosis. Oh. So.
Thank you, Senator. Absolutely.
Doctor, you can't do testing.
Thank you, Senator. Absolutely. I think this is precisely what we have had, you know, a lot of recommendations for really expanding this. We're very open. You know, I don't know if we need to identify a specific group. We'll be happy to entertain a motion for that. But we have room right now for we're expanding the number to 20. And then I think, you know, we can talk about recommendations for specific groups that need to be included. So these are just mentioned in the legislation because these are clearly groups that need to be included.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Torres Ray, I think it's important to have a physician on there. And I noticed that you have a representative of the medical care provider community. I'm not sure how broadly you're defining that. But I do think it's important to have a psychologist, too. And I don't know if I could make that amendment at this point. If so, I would move that wherever is the appropriate place on there, that a psychologist who specialize in dementia also be a member.
Thank you, Senator. I'm okay with that amendment.
Senator Prittner-Solon, you got language?
Unless Senate Counsel has better language, I'm not sure where would be the appropriate place. It seems to be it might be between F and G, but
okay. Senator Prittner-Solon moves on page one, line 15, after the semicolon, insert G. What do you want it to say?
A psychologist who specializes in dementia care.
Insert G, a psychologist who specializes in dementia care. On that motion, Senator Torres Ray, that's okay?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chairman, this is
okay. On Senator Prittner-Solon's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Horace Ray. My comments are along the same lines of Senator Prittner-Solon, I think, in reviewing your list. I would ask maybe that you give consideration to line 1.21. I'm not sure what I think I'm understanding the why you put the Commissioner of Public Safety or designee on there. And while I think that it would be appropriate to have some input from that agency, I'm not sure if that's a necessary or integral part of your work group. I'd like to see much more direction on lines 1.22. And as I looked over the list, I was trying to match up the list with what your charge is for this group. And we have a preponderance to put together lists of work groups and with people that are interested in the issue, and that's fine. I'm interested in my desire is to make sure that you have the technical, professional expertise that is necessary so that the recommendations that come forward to the policymakers are really solid and have a high degree of integrity. I would like you to take a look at beginning on line 2.3, where you list any number of charges for this work group. I think one of the things that could be strengthened or improved is some acknowledgement that you're interested in some best practices in this area. I think you could further strengthen this by having some conversations, and I don't have any, I'm not the expert here, but I think that there continues to be work done on things that we can do to prevent or slow down the development of this disease. I don't know if that's true or not true, but anything that we can do to on the preventative side is certainly in fitting with some of our healthcare reform goals. So think in terms of prevention and quality as you are trying to delineate what the charge of this group is. And I think that that will, in fact, strengthen your recommendation so that when, at which time you're able to come back with a report, that policymakers feel that the expertise has been at the table and that there's been a great consideration given to some of those themes that we're all striving for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Lynch, I really appreciate your comments because I totally agree that we could really strengthen this language by dealing with really looking at research and prevention, best practices. I think, you know, the recommendation at this point was really to only deal with putting together a plan. My hope is that these recommendations and this work that will be done with this group will bring those recommendations to our attention. But I believe that this, the staff needs to tell me, where is this bill going to at this point?
State and local, where they will be.
To state and local. You know, there is an opportunity where we could talk a little bit about incorporating some of that language into this. I think, again, the intent here was really to put together this group, give them the opportunity to really explore this and present recommendations. But the language is not as inclusive and as strong as you are proposing it should be, and I agree with that.
And I think the two witnesses made it clear that the intent is pretty similar to what you were.
Yeah.
I think that's what I was hearing. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Torres-Ray, just a comment more than anything. I have a newspaper clipping on my desk that I just brought back that I read this last weekend in my hometown paper about Alzheimer's costs, and it was just a national article that just ran in all the papers talking about the fact that this is we're spending triple the amount on senior citizens that have Alzheimer's compared to the general population of the same age group. So even though we're mostly focused on our budget at hand and all these crises of the moment, I think it's really important to be coming up with long-term, have some long-term vision and be coming up with plans. So I think this is a great bill, and I'd love to co-author with you.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Torres-Ray, one comment, page 2, line 30, it says at least 4 working group meetings must be public meetings. My understanding of open meeting law is they would all be open meetings. And I wonder if you might want to just amend it so it would read, there must be at least 4 working group meetings. I mean, there are exceptions to the open meeting law, but they're for discussing confidential types of personal information or lawsuits and so on. And I don't know that you get tripped up in Judiciary Committee, but I think you might want to be open to amendment on that. I mean, is there a reason for closing these meetings?
No, Senator. To my understanding, there isn't. I think they are probably trying to make clear these are working group meetings, so it will not be the actual, the actual group.
But even those meetings are supposed to, unless they're discussing personnel information and certain, there are about 5 or 6 exceptions.
And I wonder if that language is necessary in here, but I could talk to the staff about whether or not this language is necessary.
I would recommend, unless you're trying to keep them closed for some reason, in which case Judiciary might want to see it, but you just change the language to, Senate Counsel, could you?
Mr. Chairman. I would just suggest after the head note meetings, the working group must hold at least 4 meetings, comma.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think you are correct. And to my knowledge, there is really no strong feeling in here. And I think that we simply could say meetings must be open to the public to the extent practicable and just delete in line 230. Delete at least 4 working group meetings. I don't think that's necessary. And just start with meetings. Meetings must be open.
Meetings must be, so you'd like it to read, meetings must be open to the public, comma, on the first line. Mm-hmm. Senator Torres Ray moves on line 30, delete existing language and replace it with meetings must be open to the public, comma.
Okay.
Yep, discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Other further discussion? If not, Senator Torres Ray moves Senate file 1799 is amended to be recommended passed, referred to the Committee on State and Local Governments. Further discussion on that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Senate file 1924.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I do have an amendment.
A1 amendment?
Yes.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 author's amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate File 1924 deals with providing more information on our managed care and county-based purchasing reimbursement rates and providing more information about how the increases that are received by health plan companies are being used. And I have a witness to testify, Mr. Renner, and I might just add while he's coming up here that over the years of working on the budget, we also have had questions about exactly how the managed care health plan rates get put together. And there is a requirement in federal law that those rates have to be actuarially sound, but it isn't always clear exactly what that means. So I think having more information would be useful.
Okay. Mr. Renner, you want to go first?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association, representing over 10,000 physicians, medical students, medical residents. Here today in support of Senate File 1924. As you know, payment reform is a significant focus of our health care reform activities, and we would say that's appropriate. But for true payment reform to occur, we believe we need to make sure there is transparency in how our current funds are being used. And meaningful information needs to be available both to the public and to you, the policymakers, with respect to how state dollars are spent on our existing PMAP programs. This bill is intended to try to make transparent information that we believe has been shielded from that public light for too long. I want to share what this bill does, but also what this bill does not do. This bill is not about challenging the basic ideas or values associated with using managed care organizations to administer our state's public programs. This bill is rather about transparency and accountability and oversight. As contractors with the state, health plans are receiving public dollars, and as such, the MMA believes that the public and the state and policymakers have both a right and an obligation to ensure that state dollars are used as effectively and efficiently as possible, ensuring access to care for state public program enrollees. And we believe this bill will help do that. We also believe this bill is not about eliminating the opportunity for health plans to make or to earn a reasonable profit on the business that they do in PMAP. Rather, we think the bill is about understanding how and why such profits occur and ensuring that such profits come at the expense of provider viability and thereby threatening access to availability of care. Every year since 1998, with the exception of 2006, Minnesota health plans in aggregate have reported annual profits from the business they do in PMAP. While some will argue that health plan margins are very small, most physicians will tell you that their margins are non-existent in our public programs. We think this bill, again, is just intended to help better understand whether access is being threatened and how those payments are being used. Also, this bill is not seeking to publicize clinic-specific or detailed payment rates. Rather, this bill is focused on generating sufficient detail on how health plans are paying for care delivered to our public program enrollees to ensure that the increases in rates that are defined either by you, the legislature, or the rate-setting process actually end up in the hands of those delivering the care. In conversations we've had with DHS staff, they have acknowledged at times that because they don't have access to this data, they cannot be certain that all the payments that you all dictate shall be increased are necessarily being passed through. They can't verify that the legislative mandated payments are being used as was intended. And finally, Mr. Chair and members, I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to again remind the legislature that the state's current Medicaid fee-for-service payments, rates that also serve for many of the plans to be the base for the PMAP payments that they use for providing payment providers, are also woefully inadequate. Physician practices, like all businesses, are facing increases in the cost of doing business, yet the state has provided only one across-the-board payment increase, a 3% increase in year 2000. Since 1992. While physicians continuously step up to the plate and provide access to Medicaid patients, we are the current economics are not sustainable. So in conclusion, this bill, again, is not trying to attack the health plans or say that we shouldn't be doing PMAP, but is trying to make sure that you as policymakers have some understanding, transparency, in the amounts of money that you're appropriating to those plans so that we better understand how that money is being used. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Renner. Questions? Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Renner, I don't know if this is for you or Senator Berglund. And the subspecialties part of this, is that also going to include dental care as well? The provisions for that are just for medical?
Mr. Chair and members, how I would read the language, I think it's talking about all the payments that are used through the PMAP program. So if PMAP payments include dental coverage, then we would think that's part of the requirement to report back would be how those monies are being used in dental services as well.
And Mr. Chair, one last question, if I might. The date, the time that we're looking at it, December 15, 2010, it seems like this information is something that we could use on a more, you know, a little bit quicker than that, and it seems like information they could probably come up with a little quicker. Is there a reason why we're giving them over a year and a half to come up with this information?
Mr. Chair and members, when the bill was drafted, if you look at the current section that it's drafted to, Subdivision 9B, the current language was just adopted by the legislature last year, and the effective date for that subdivision doesn't take place until January 1 of 2010. If the legislature would like, if you'd like to move those dates up, we would not oppose that, but we would just base it off the current statute.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, would it be helpful to have this sooner than rather than later?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, of course it would be helpful to have information sooner, but with the health reform bill that was passed last session, we funded it to be on this schedule, and so I don't think we can change it now.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Renner. The amendment strikes or restores the stricken language on 2.1, so it says non-public data. But then on the final line, 2.9, it says the information has to be released to the public. Is that a conflict within the language of this bill? That's one question, and I have another one.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, no, I don't believe it is. Our original draft, we would like this all the data that's submitted to be public, but we run into concerns on getting through deadlines. How I would read that, the information that is submitted by the health plans on the first page would be now considered non-public. However, the report that's required under paragraph D, that information analysis that the commissioner does with that data would be made available to the public.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And Mr. Renner, this information that we're requiring, is this also provided? You know, we've got the state employee group insurance plan. Do we require this kind of information from that case as well? And if not, why not?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, the state employees are self-insured. So we contract with organizations to be our fiscal intermediary, but we are a self-insured plan. So it wouldn't be applicable, I don't think.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I appreciate that. I guess the argument was that this is, you know, public money being spent, and that's why we should have access to the information, and it's public money being spent for employees' health care as well, state employees. I just am not sure I'm buying the argument here that because it's public money we ought to do this. I'm a little concerned about why and what the information is going to be used for, and whether or not this does some harm potentially to the ability of private entities to do their business without running risk of having put in a position where they're not be able to be competitive.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, you know, I guess I'd look at it from the other side. I would say you and I both vote for bills that provide this money. And when you go back home and talk to providers in your district and you tell them 1 year we gave an increase for mental health, and you tell them we did that, and a provider looks at you and says, well, I didn't get an increase, how do you answer that? I mean, that was the intention of the legislature. That is what the money was appropriated for. I mean, and the provider may be wrong, but you don't have any way to know that.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I appreciate that, and you're right. But sometimes we do tax relief, and people come and say, I didn't get any tax relief. And that's because we don't know the whole details of their life and how they deal with their finances, and there may be things that would give them the tax relief or not, I don't know, but I guess that's what I'm getting at is if what we're saying is that we're going to require every health provider to reveal every bit of data to us as a legislature, then it really becomes inconsequential to have the private marketplace be engaged with the government. And I'm a little concerned about that in terms of just the trend or the direction that we're headed here, and I'm not quite sure if I understand the need to do this and what we would do with the information, but I you know, I'm just not clear here what this is headed for.
Ms. Dyker, are you wishing to speak as well, or are you mainly to answer questions? I don't know. Go ahead if you wish to.
A little of both, maybe. My name is Barb Dyker, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to this committee. I am the executive director of Northwest Eye Clinic. We're an ophthalmology practice on the west side of town. And today I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Group Manager Association. We are also in support of Senate File 1924. As has been discussed, there have been increases that have been passed along to the entities that are managing the PMAP. The association that I belong to, we have not been able to identify any providers that have received any increases in the last decade in terms of reimbursement. In fact, our particular practice, I just checked our data yesterday, and we have seen a decrease of 7% in our overall reimbursement with an increase of 3% in the number of patients that we're seeing. So there's a significant effect that's going on, and it is actually reaching the point where it is below our cost to deliver some of these services, definitely. We're a comprehensive ophthalmology practice, so we're seeing kids and adults and all of that across the board. All those things are happening. It is just in response a little bit to the dialogue that was occurring earlier. One of the differences between DOER and what's happening with the PMAP program is DOER is negotiated through the health plan's reimbursement contracts. So as a provider, I will negotiate with Medica or Health Partners or whoever is administering DOER on what rates I'm going to get paid, and I can check to be sure that that's being done correctly. With the PMAP program, that rate has been dictated already. There's no negotiations to it. And if increases are being passed along to the health plans, at least at this point, then that's why we were asking the questions. How come we haven't seen a raise in like 10 years? I mean, what's going on with that? Well, we come to find out that there's been a 46% increase cumulatively that's happened for the health plans, and we haven't seen any of it. And so it is a little different strategy because I don't get to negotiate when it comes to what I get paid for PMAP. That's set already, whereas with DOER, I negotiate with Medica or with health partners on what my reimbursement rate is going to be and may choose not to participate as well if the rate isn't adequate. Let's see. So, in other words, we are also very much in support of the idea that there should be transparency. That's the critical piece. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Brittner Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, just as an example, we've often had increases in our fee-for-service, and also there have been attempts to increase our PMAP payments. Well, we can see that there are changes in fee-for-service, but we never see any evidence that any of the PMAP increases get passed through to the providers.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, and Senator Brittner Solon. Presumably, what happens to the increase then?
Probably there's with the health plan.
And Mr. Chairman,
and Senator Hand, that is the $64,000 question.
And Mr. Chairman, and
I, as chair of the budget division, can't answer that question for you. You should be concerned.
Mr.
Chairman and Senator Berglund, I'm just wondering if there's anybody from a health plan who's here that might want to try to answer the question, where does the money go? I'm just curious to find out.
Ms. Brunner is sitting right behind them, and I'm guessing she might want to speak. I will ask her if she wishes to. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Ms. Brunner, did you wish to speak now that you've slipped up right behind me? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Marty and members of the committee. My name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The Council of Health Plans is the trade association for the 8 nonprofit HMOs in Minnesota. The health plans question the need for this bill since reporting provider payment rates was part of the health reform legislation passed last year in this section of statute. In conversations with the bill's proponents, it seems that they're interested in highlighting the fact that providers are not getting paid more by the health plans, even though over a course of years, payments to the health plans have gone up. The health plan's position on additional funds received over the years is that the increases have been tied to serving more clients, covering more types of services, more mandates, and paying for increased utilization of services because of factors like chronic conditions, which cost more to treat. The plans do not receive cost of living increases in their rates. I think we can all agree that the fee-for-service rates are low and that an increase, especially for primary care, would be great. PMAP rates paid by the plans to providers are based generally, but not in the case of all plans, on MA fee-for-service rates. These rates have not been increased for many years. Most managed care companies use the fee-for-service rate or pay fee-for-service plus some additional percentage. And at least one of the health plans uses the relative value units in rate setting. So how does DHS determine what it pays health plans? I've had an opportunity to be in a couple of meetings with the proponents of the bill and with the Department of Human Services, and although this is not my area of expertise at all, I've learned a lot about PMAP rates in the last few weeks. The rates DHS pays to the health plans are based on the fee-for-service rate with adjustments for what DHS terms trend. Trend includes changes in eligibility, increased enrollment, the demographics of enrollees in a particular plan, some recognition of geographic differences, access issues, legislatively mandated benefit changes, legislative directives for specific provider increases to be passed through, which I think there's been one since 2002, changes in utilization of services and administrative costs, which the legislature capped last year. My understanding is that DHS considers this sort of a case mix that is used when determining rates paid to the individual health plans. And I want to stress again, the health plans do not get cost of living increases or COLAs, but their rates are based on the factors I mentioned. It's unclear in looking at the bill exactly what the administrative impact of Senate File 1924 would have on the current reporting requirements that the plans and county-based purchasing programs have under their contracts to DHS. I've talked to a couple of folks from the plans who do reporting, and they've expressed concern that tracking some of this information at this level of detail will create additional administrative costs for the health plans. What's even more concerning here is that the legislature established administrative caps on managed care organizations last year. I've spoken to Senator Berglund. We'd like to work with Senator Berglund as this bill progresses to try to mitigate the impact on the county-based purchasing and the health plans as the legislation moves forward. Last year, the legislature authorized DHS to collect information on reimbursement rates paid by the health plans and county-based purchasing. We, again, believe that department should have a chance to implement this legislation. If the adequacy of payment levels and fee-for-service are the real issue, the solution is for the legislature to increase fee-for-service rates. The issue is getting more granular information from health plans and county-based purchasing on what's paid to providers. I hope that we can spend time trying to figure out how to do that without increasing administrative costs in managed care. If providers want information on fee schedules, that's available from each of the payer organizations. If the legislature seeks more accountability, then I think we need to stop and examine what kind of information and accountability you already get in the way more than 100 reports that health plans and county-based purchasing organizations already provide every year to DHS. We believe that the legislature did some great work in healthcare reform last year, and we'd like to keep the focus on reform. We'd like to keep a focus on how these various proposals impact and benefit consumers. What connection cost and quality have to each other? What healthcare really costs, not necessarily what's paid for healthcare? And how paying for baskets of care, episodes of care, or total cost of care could impact health care costs in Minnesota. Again, as the bill proceeds, we want to work with the author to try to mitigate the administrative burden that this legislation will have for county-based purchasing and the health plans.
Thank you, Ms. Brunner. Senator Hand, but before you do that, I don't want to tell committee members not to ask questions, but I want to remind people we are on the third of 10 bills, and we have to be out of here at 3 o'clock, and we were hoping not to have any more night meetings. But having said that, please ask questions you feel a need for.
Thank you.
Senator Hand, and I'll say the same for witnesses, to please try and be brief.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will try to be brief, and I just wanted to ask the witness, looking at page 1, number 2, that talks about evidences that increases in payments made to the plan are passed through. I'm reading this and I'm thinking, well, what we're trying to do is lay the groundwork to say, here's a law that requires you to pass through whatever X amount or some formula or something. And if we were to do that, how would that affect what you do?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, there's been one increase in the last X number of years, and my understanding is that that increase was passed through. This would, I expect, require the plans to track it somehow and have that information available. I don't know if there's a challenge to the fact that that one-time increase was passed through or not. But it would require a tracking of it, which is a reasonable, I mean.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe you misunderstood. I'm just saying that if we collect this information as the bill requires, and then sometime down the road we say, well, now we think that you're getting an increase, but you're not passing that through, so now we're going to write a law that requires you to pass through higher amounts to your, and I'm just asking, if we were to do that, what would that mean for you if we passed that subsequent law?
I think we do that like for nursing homes. I mean, when we pass things and we require a certain percentage be paid in wage increases and so on. But
that's my question.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I hope I'm not being too dense here. Obviously, passing the legislation to require the pass-through would require the health plan to pass that increase through in payment rates to the provider. This legislation would then require the payers to keep track and, I suppose, be able to provide evidence that payment was passed through. I hope I answered your question.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I just have to challenge this idea that there are not increases being given, even when the legislature doesn't specifically pass a rate increase to the fee-for-service program. In 2007, figured into the rate for physicians was a 3% utilization increase and a 2.5% increase in charges. And that's done because we have to meet the actuarial soundness standard. So the total for physicians that year was 5.58%. In 2008, the utilization increase for physicians was 6%, and the charge increase was 1%. So the total increase that year for physicians was 7.06%. So, and every year that I can see, there's an automatic 3% administrative trend adjustment. So the legislature, all we have to do, and of course we have to do it, is pass our budget bill. And there's something in there in terms of the department's forecast for the managed care contracts to meet the actuarial soundness standard.
Senator Berglund moves Senate File 1924 as amended be recommended pass. Does this go to finance?
Yes, I think we need to make sure that the duties of the department here aren't going to.
Okay, is there anybody else who wishes to speak with concerns about the bill? Is there any further discussion? If not, Senator Berglund's motion, bill be recommended pass, referred to Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, moving right along, Senate File 923.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill is a bill that deals with contact lens prescriptions, and it just changes the number of years that a prescription that's written by an optometrist or a physician would expire. And
we have that in law.
I have Dr. Jonathan Scorn here testify on behalf of the bill.
Dr. Shorin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Senator Berglund said, my name is Jonathan Shorin. I'm an optometrist in practice in Apple Valley. I'm here representing the Minnesota Optometric Association today. And the need for this bill is simply to bring the Minnesota state law into conformity with the federal contact lens law by setting that maximum expiration date for a contact lens prescription at 1 year. And the difference here is basically created confusion among the public, among providers, and among contact lens sellers. And along with that, the standard of care for contact lenses is basically 1 year of evaluation when a person is wearing contact lens to make sure that the front surface of the eye is not suffering any adverse reactions. And that's pretty much the standard of care throughout the country. We are one of only a handful of states where that contact lens prescription is greater than 1 year. Both ophthalmologists and optometrists in the state agree and across the country agree that that standard of care is 1 year. Both groups here in Minnesota have met and agree that, you know, that this bill is in the best interest of a patient statewide. I ask you to think about a pharmaceutical prescription. If you went in and you needed to have cholesterol medication, for instance, if you at the end of the year said, well, I'm doing pretty well, I think I can just get that for a little bit longer, can't I? You know, your physician would say, no, I need to run blood tests, I need to evaluate and make sure that, you know, everything is good. And that's essentially what patients are coming in saying, well, I feel like I'm doing okay, can't I just have this for longer? Well, and our law says they can. And at the same time, I'm sitting telling my patients on a daily basis that contact lenses are an optional way of correcting your vision. You can certainly wear glasses if you choose. The challenge is if you wear contact lenses, that sits on that surface of the eye and it can have some interactions with your body as a pharmaceutical can. And it's my job then to evaluate that and make sure that that no adverse reactions are occurring. They may need, you know, I tell them that they need more extensive follow-up care than a general individual then for eye care. And so that basically is that standard of care, once again, of 1 year. So I'm constantly on a daily basis telling my patients that, you know, the cornea, the front window of the eye, is very much like the windshield in a car. You know, it has to remain clear to see out through that. If you start getting pits, scratches, cracks in that windshield, you're not going to see well. And it's easier to replace the windshield on your car than it is to replace the surface of your eye. And so I tell people that I need to make sure that their cornea remains healthy, and in order to do that, I need to evaluate them on a regular basis. And so basically what we're saying here is that most doctors here in Minnesota are currently following the federal standard of 1 year, and we're just trying to get that change to clarify that single clinical statutory standard here in Minnesota as well.
Dr. Shorn or Senator Berglund, question about that, though. Like, standard of care for dental care, I keep being told by my dentist, is every 6 months to go in for a change. But we don't usually, it seems to me, you have to write into the law the standard of care. I mean, it seems to me you and your colleagues would just be telling your patients, come in every year for it. Is there a reason that this is dangerous? I mean, I realize what you said. I mean, it's dangerous not to get your teeth taken care of either. I was just curious why we have to write that into the law.
Mr. Chairman, it's because it is a prescription. And we do put into law currently for prescriptions the length of time that a prescription is good without getting to see a physician.
Mr.
And
Chair,
this is already in state law. As you can see, we're just changing it. So being that it's already in state law, they just would like it to conform with the federal standards.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund or I'm sorry, Dr. Shorn, is it? I have a question, though. I mean, I think it's generally accepted that eyes change for a good frequently for a while, and then after people get older, then they tend to be more stable again and need to be changed less frequently. A lot of people are on Medicare. A lot of people have a hard time paying for those prescriptions and those new glasses. Does that mean then that if their glasses break and it's a year, that they're going to have to go back and get another exam and a new prescription before they could get those those prescriptions filled? And currently, they would be able to just get them filled within that two-year period.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Senator, this does not at all apply to glasses prescriptions, which will remain at the two-year expiration date. And as you mentioned, you know, Medicare patients will be in glasses as opposed to contact lenses. And so it doesn't quite apply. But again, it goes back to...
It doesn't say that, though. It doesn't say...
Senator Pritner, so it's just the section, I presume, that this is amending. The subdivision 2 is...
Contact lenses.
Yeah. Senator Johnson.
Right. This statute only applies to the contact lenses. So, again, the glasses are in a separate area. But, again, it goes back to what I mentioned earlier, is that a lot of patients will tell me, well, my vision's not changing. I say that may very well be true. But when you are wearing a contact lens as opposed to glasses, there is some interaction of the eye and that corneal tissue. I need to make sure that that's healthy. And the only way to do that is to do an evaluation on a regular basis. So we're telling people yearly, but in the law it says 2 years. There's confusion there, and we're trying to clarify that.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not all health insurance plans cover eye and ophthalmology. So to make that patient go back, to get it refilled if it's not, you know, if their insurance has changed or something. That's kind of a strain on their budget.
Dr. Shorn, I kind of think that unless 2 years is really dangerous, that the idea that it's better to do every year, I think Senator Johnson's comments, I mean, it seems to me you're saying, well, you might confuse them. If we say come back every year and this is good for 2 years, well, I mean, you can explain why you want them to come back every year. But Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, is this, in your opinion, is this going to increase health care costs? Is one question I have. And the question that I have from Dr. Shorn is there data to suggest in Minnesota that this is problematic, that this is a change that is, in fact, necessary? Do we have data to suggest that?
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, contact lenses are usually considered an optional service, and so they're not covered by the health plan. It's an out-of-pocket expense for people. So, you know, I don't think it's going to increase insurance costs. And, you know, if you don't feel you can afford contact lenses, then you can always get regular glasses.
Senator Berger, aren't the exams themselves covered, though?
I believe the exam is an exam is covered every year, but there's no reason to know if the person is going in to have an exam because they've been wearing their contact lenses at night when they're not supposed to and they've gotten an infection, or whether they're going in because they think there's a change in their vision, or if there's another reason for concern. Obviously, if they're a diabetic, they're supposed to be getting their eyes checked annually anyway. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, I'm not aware of any data specifically, as you asked for. I can only tell you from my standpoint of what I'm seeing. I see people come in, even though I've explained to them, this is what I expect for you to do, coming in with problems, having overworn their contacts because they believe that the law allows them to do that. And we're just trying to, again, clarify that.
Senator Dalgas, you have your hand up.
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, on the prescriptions between for contact lenses versus glasses, are they different? Are they a different prescription?
Yes. Mr. Chair, the contact lens prescription certainly is different. It requires curvature measurements, diameter sizes that are not required with a glasses prescription. So, yeah, they're totally two different things.
Okay. Thank you.
Further discussion on the bill. Is there anyone who wishes to speak with concerns about the bill? Now, there's further discussion from the committee. That Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 923 Senate File 923 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Chair's in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hands. 2, 3, 4, 5. All those opposed? On a tie vote, the motion does not prevail. Wait, I forgot to count. Oh, I did count her. 5.
Yep. No.
5.
Oh, you did.
Motion does.
Let's try
count again.
Let's
count
do
again.
Over. Okay.
All those in favor, raise your hands.
4, 5, 6.
Yeah, I missed it. 6-5 vote. The motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Drink
coffee all day. 11:55. And I'll keep reminding committee members we've got a long way to go in the agenda, so let's try and move as quickly as we can. You have a delete everything amendment you'd like offered?
I do. It's the A5 amendment being passed out now.
Senator Erickson Ropes moves the A5 amendment to put the bill in the shape she wishes it to be in. Do you mind if we vote? If you don't have it, it's an author's amendment. You don't have the bill yet, I gather. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Erickson Ropes. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a really good bill here today, and it It comes from Denny Feed, who is from Winona and represents, or is the executive director of the Home and Community Options service in Winona. And they were looking at all the cuts that are going to be, we're going to be passing along to Health and Human Services. And instead of just talking about, complaining about cuts and here's why not to cut them, Mr. Thede started working with a stakeholder group of people to say, okay, cuts are coming. What can we do to prepare for them? What can we change? And what kind of solutions can we bring back that will help? So he has worked for a long time with a stakeholder group of people. And I want also, although they're not here to testify, I just want to acknowledge in the room we have Amanda Lowen, who is a self-advocate. You want to wave everybody, Amanda?
Welcome. Thank you for coming.
She lives in the homes. And her dad, Gene Lauer, next to her. And then Tracy Luskowski, who's a guardian and advocate. And so we bring some recommended changes that will help adult foster care homes be able to deal with the impending cuts. And I'll have Mr. Thede walk you through the bill.
Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Marty, Senator Ropes, and members of the committee. Home and Community Options is a nonprofit in Winona County that supports 240 individuals with developmental disabilities. We have realized over the last 6 years some stress in our budgets, as you know from many of your constituents in your districts, that the increases in COLA and provider increases have not kept up with the inflationary increases, and our records show about a 10% loss over the last 6 years in keeping up with the times. As you know, thanks to many of you, we take great pride in our services to people with developmental disabilities. We've come a long way, and you do not need to go far from Minnesota to realize that we're a benchmark for other states in terms of our quality of service. We have looked at, as a nonprofit, the most practical methods to address the forecasted budget that has been presented by our governor at this point, realizing that that's not resolved yet, but expecting in the dire situations of our current economy that there probably is the need to do that. We have really looked at the principles that have brought Minnesota to the forefront in terms of normalization, community integration, and proactive support and treatment to people with disabilities. No one can deny that our service system is better than it's ever been for people with disabilities, and we're thankful for that. As Senator Ropes indicated, people like Jean, Tracy, and Amanda have been part of our process of figuring out how to fix the budget, and we've been trying to be proactive. One of the things that came up in our discussions was the idea that current licensure of 4 people living in a home could possibly be increased to 5 people without hardship and without a violation of the principles that we've aspired to. And I believe that you received a handout, but the impact of the governor's budget at 3% reduction in provider rates would account for $240,000 for our nonprofit. That's a lot of money. And while we've taken some action already to cut our expenses by about 2%, we cannot get to 3%. We cannot get to 3% without cutting infrastructure. And the real pragmatic statement that I'll make to you is that by cutting more staff in a 4-person's home, if we had to do that, that would impact people so that they couldn't be in the community as much. They wouldn't get the individual care that they need. And so we looked at the reality of changing some of our programs where 5 people could live in an environment where we could actually maintain or enhance staffing and allow for a better quality of life with community integration, with the individualized care that we have. And the sensibility of it is reinforced by the comments made from just about every group of stakeholders that we talk to. So I share that with you in this bill in support of just a pragmatic approach to it. Now, there are some concerns, and the moral process of it is something that we've looked very seriously at. While we'll save anywhere from 96 to 130,000 by closing just one home, and that would get us to a level where we could address a 3% rate cut. We cannot go back to any institutional care. How big is too big? Well, we know that four has been served us well, but is five going to be a negative impact on people? We do not believe so in the long run. We feel that we need to have a rule that I think it's identified very clearly, that the providers need to be accountable that this this rate, this provision would enhance or at least maintain the quality of service without going into the hands of a provider that's not looking at the best intent of the individuals. We also know that there needs to be an informed consent process. We can't just direct this to our constituents. We need to have their active participation. And I have confidence that our constituents will be in agreement with it. So while this presents some philosophical dilemmas for us, we believe it's practical in the current times. It will bridge us over until we can look at more consumer-directed models that certainly we're looking at. This doesn't get us fix the problem for the long run. We need to be creative as providers and administration to really do better with less money. We know that. But we believe this is at least a step in the right direction in the short run. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Thede. This is a permanent change if the rates go down this year. It's not, in other words, you're not doing this just for 2 years or 4 years. You'd be making a permanent change to five.
Yeah, the house is affected within the biennium, as the language in the bill identifies, would not be affected at a future time. However, the provision does allow providers to do it only for the two-year period until 2011. Then it basically sunset.
And, Mr. Chair, in addition, it's only if the rate reductions make it through the legislature.
I see that. I just wondered. So it is sunsetted in effect that the five-person is 2 years. Okay. Questions from the committee. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so how many closings would this be? How many homes would this close?
We're looking at it for our practical purposes, where we would only need to close one home, where four people would have to move to four other homes.
And Mr. Chairman, and that means you are not going to sell that home that you're hoping to reopen it in 2011.
No, in our case, that would be a downsize of that service for forever. The four people that moved would continue to reside in the residence they're moved to for as long as it's appropriate for them to do
Mr.
so.
Mr. Chair, so do you plan to sell that home?
That's the provision, Senator Johnson, I'm sorry. That's the provision that allows us the cost savings.
And, Mr. Chair, what if the market doesn't allow for the sale?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, in our case, we have a combination of rental properties and owned homes. So obviously we would look at rental properties first. It could be that's our situation. It could be in some cases where providers would have to acknowledge the reality of selling a home if they were going to institute this provision.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to remind members of the committee that there's a budget deficit for the second biennium as well as for the first biennium that we're dealing with the budget. And I also would just like to say that I don't think having a policy where we would be moving people around every 2 years based on the budget would be a very good idea. I mean, I think once somebody is relocated, they should stay where they are.
On that point, Senator Berglund, I'm wondering when I asked if this was sunsetted, in effect, doesn't that mean you would be moving them back in 2 years? Or, in other words, it's only sunset for who can add the fifth person. It's permanently that would be five people in the homes that are allowed to do it in the next 2 years.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that is correct. The people that would move during this period of time would be allowed the provision of staying in the environment that they choose to. I want to remind the committee that there is informed consent in this required from not only the people who are moving, but also for the four people that are residing in a home now to accept another roommate. So there's that transparency there. And then after 2 years, the provision would go away, and depending on the circumstances at that time, if we as a state wanted to continue this provision, it would have to be reintroduced to carry on longer.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you going to add a provider with the addition to the homes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, provider meaning additional staffing?
An additional hours of staffing.
Our plan to meet the governor's proposed 3% cut, we could add to every one of those four homes 20 hours of staff service per week. So that's actually, we're without looking at who it is, we believe that there's the cost savings to mitigate the potential rate cuts and still provide enhanced staffing to address the needs of five people versus four.
Sarah Johnson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, one more question. Do your current providers feel they can handle that in as like if you're just adding hours without a person, can they handle it as a staff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, yes, we had our staff involved in this discussion from the get-go, and we would have enhanced staffing in the homes for the five people versus four in our case to meet the needs. So we take advantage of the downtime, if you will, in a program where we probably don't have enhanced staffing to have five people versus four, but we have additional staff when we need it to address the needs of five people. This bill is clearly to not compromise quality and to ensure that people still continue to get out in the community.
Further questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak with concerns about the bill? Is there further discussion from the committee? If not, Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File 1155. Is it amended? As amended, be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Mm-hmm. Sir Erickson Ropes, I like the way you started in introducing your bill. You're a good salesperson. This is a very good bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's not often we get people coming here with local solutions that should be able to. They're just asking for flexibility in how they deliver the program, still trying to maintain quality, and they just need some flexibility.
And I have some concerns about, but I think it's worth trying. I mean, I realize we're in the fear I have is then a couple years from now we decide that we don't have the money, so we're going to decide we're going to cut back the funding for the five-bed. I mean, we just keep in a cycle, so I think we got to watch that. On Senator Erickson Rope's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Erickson Rope, you have another bill.
I do.
File 1512. Senator Johnson, when you said, sorry, you have another question, don't apologize. I was not meaning to cut off questions. I'm just saying be sensitive to the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have another bill with another group of people bringing together potential funding source and a request. This has to do with families and individuals who have children that are deaf and hard of hearing. And Senate File 1512 has to do with this these children and their families. New research shows that if we find children early in life and get them early diagnosis and early intervention and into some kind of programming by the age of 6 months, that these children's language skills are the same as their peers by age five. And we need to continue to provide families with support to access and information and connection to other families so that they can make some crucial decisions. In 2007, the Parents Guides Network, which is a nonprofit, received $199,000 of general fund money on a two-year basis. And because we know the state can't afford another general fund appropriation to continue this important program, we are seeking to increase the hospital blood spot fee from $101 to $105. That's a $4 increase in order to pay for this program. So I have with me today Candace Lindau-Davies. She's the coordinator for the Minnesota Hands and Voices program. She'll talk to you a little bit about what's going on with that program. And then we have a parent guide, Kristen Hemstock, who's here, and Renee Steffen, who is a parent. So I will turn it over to Kristen, or Candace, I'm sorry.
No, thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Erickson-Ropes. My name is Candace Lindau-Davies. I'm the proud mother of a 13-year-old son who's profoundly deaf. I'm also privileged to be the coordinator of Minnesota Hands and Voices at LifeTrack Resources, the only statewide parent-to-parent support network for Minnesota families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Today, I ask for your support for a $4 increase to the hospital blood spot fee. Minnesota Hands and Voices started at LifeTrack Resources in 2000, primarily as a metro service through the Greater Twin Cities United Way. For the past 7 years, the Minnesota Department of Health charged with the task of implementing universal newborn hearing screening and an early hearing detection and intervention system has contracted with LifeTrack Resources to provide unbiased parent-to-parent support throughout the state. In response, Minnesota Hands and Voices built a network of trained parent guides in each of 7 regions, both outstate and metro, offering parents local support and connection to community resources. Parent guides undergo extensive and ongoing training provided by such sources as Minnesota Department of Health, National Hands and Voices, PACER Center, Center for Disease Control, Fairview University Medical Center, and others. In 2008, Department of Health entrusted Minnesota Hands and Voices parent guides with the responsibility of calling families with newly diagnosed children on behalf of the Department of Health. Harnessing the passion and experience of parents who themselves navigated the system to ensure new families are emotionally supported, encouraged to return for necessary follow-up health care appointments, and are linked with the existing early intervention system has been an overwhelming success. You should have a written handout from two deaf, hard of hearing teachers endorsing our services. But this has also meant a 39% increase in families and professionals served by Minnesota Hands and Voices in 2008 over 2007. It has also resulted in a 54% increase in families connected to parent-to-parent support, which is a national CDC goal. Minnesota Hands and Voices helped 929 unduplicated families and professionals in 2008 with just over 2.5 FTEs statewide. As you may already know, in 2007, community stakeholders came before this legislature and passed a mandate to screen every newborn for hearing loss, funded by an increase to the blood spot fee. In the same year, Minnesota Hands and Voices also came before you and received an allocation, which Senator Erickson-Ropes mentioned. But that does end this June. Although the Minnesota Department of Health has temporarily given us financial support until June of 2010, their current level of funding cannot sustain us. We are sensitive to the state's current financial crisis. We are also respectfully asking that Minnesota Hands and Voices be included in the blood spot fee funding to ensure consistency throughout the state and protect the safety net we have built to ensure that each child with hearing loss get appropriate services and support. While corporate and foundation grants have helped support this project, consistency and continuation of the program requires a public investment. The cost savings and reduced special education of identifying and intervening with one child with bilateral deafness, according to CDC, is $4,500 per year. Over the course of a child's education, intervening with only a handful of kids would cover the full cost of the Minnesota Hands and Voices program for 1 year. We ask for your investment in the future of our children who are deaf and hard of hearing. I thank you for this opportunity to speak before you, and I invite you to listen to the experiences of two other parents.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask both other parents to please be as brief as you can because we have some other bills we need to get to because they're going to other committees, and today's last day we can deal with them. So please go ahead, but please be brief.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Erickson-Ropes, and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Hemstock, and I'm a parent guide working at Minnesota Hands and Voices. I live in Mankato, and I serve the southwest part of Minnesota. I have a 10-year-old son who was born hard of hearing. I'm here today to support a comprehensive system that ensures that each child with hearing loss will get appropriate services and support in a timely manner. I believe Minnesota has this in place right now. I've been working as a parent guide for 3 years now. As a parent, I understand firsthand the overwhelming nature of a child's hearing loss diagnosis. Perhaps a child with hearing loss is a newborn, or perhaps he has other complex issues, or maybe his family doesn't speak English. What are the necessary components to move a family forward? What kind of support does a family need to seek the services and information needed to make sound decisions? First of all, a family needs to feel supported. They need someone to say, "You're not alone. I have been there before, and there are various paths to take. Others have taken these paths before you and have been successful. Let me guide you. Let me connect you. I will support you while you have concerns and questions. I will give you the tools and the encouragement and support to navigate this difficult time." Parent guides are uniquely able to provide these things. We first and foremost provide parent support. The current system is working. Let me highlight one of the families I'm working with. Their newborn son did not pass his newborn hearing screening. The family was immediately referred to an audiologist who diagnosed him with a profound hearing loss. She referred the family directly to me. The family is from Somalia and did not speak English well. We used an interpreter. I spoke with them on the telephone a number of times. With the help of the interpreter, we spoke about her beautiful newborn son. We spoke about getting connected with local resources and returning for necessary follow-up healthcare appointments. But then she said to me, "The doctors say to me that my son does not hear, but as a mother, it is hard for me to know if he is deaf or not." At that moment, we spoke the same language. This mother was hurting. She was questioning. She was looking for someone to give her hope, to say, "I have been there, and you will get through it." I was able to give her encouragement, a connection to another local family, and the tools to move forward. This unique parent-to-parent connection proved valuable to this family and can be to so many more. In my region, I am very lucky to get direct referrals from a pediatric audiologist. The pediatric audiologist I work with had this to say about having parent guide services in our region. She said, "Minnesota Hands and Voices has been an invaluable resource for my hearing impaired patients' families. It serves as a contact point to have questions answered, and the services offer social and emotional support at a time when families need it the most. The shock, grief, and denial of finding your child has a disability can be so overwhelming. I think of Minnesota Hands and Voices as a sanctuary where families can share their thoughts, fears, and joys in a safe, supportive, and knowledgeable environment. This is more meaningful than sitting in a sterile clinic setting, listening to an audiologist discuss what they should be doing or might be feeling. Long may Minnesota Hands and Voices continue. Our pediatric hearing healthcare program depends on it." And again, that's a quote from Dr. Jenna Tunnell.
Ma'am, can we cut you off? We're running out of time. Could we have 1 minute from the parent? I'm sorry to do this, but we're very short of time.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, and members of the committee. It's Renee Steffen, and I have a 21-month-old boy. His name is Noah. He was born with a profound hearing loss. We were fortunate enough to find this hearing loss at hearing screening. He was further tested because we didn't want to quite accept right away that he was born with this hearing loss. We were overwhelmed with fear of the unknown. We live in a small town. We have never heard of a hearing loss before. I had a lot of questions, quite a few concerns, and really not a lot of hope as far as I was looking for some insight that only another mother with a child could provide. To Minnesota Hands and Voices, we were able to be connected with local families. I am grateful I was able to be connected with someone within the first 3 months of Noah's life. It saved me from feeling sorry for myself, my family, and my son. It also enabled me to accept that Noah had a problem, and it gave me hope for Noah's future. It didn't take long for my husband and I to decide that we wanted to do whatever we could to help Noah learn and develop as normal as possible. It's actually been my pleasure now, 20 months in of being a mother, to be a volunteer mentor to other families with the same problem. I've spoke with quite a few families, actually, that have gone through what I did not long ago. I just want to let you know that these services are vital for each individual family to be able to network with one another and obtain knowledge and support through other families. Without Minnesota Hands and Voices, I don't know that our family would have been able to bounce out of the pity party quite as soon as we did. Helps me every day, especially on the hard days, to know that Minnesota Hands and Voices is on my side.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Senator Erickson Ropes, I clearly think people need the support. I mean, I'm glad we got the newborn screening in for the hearing stuff and so on. Is there further discussion from the committee? Is there anybody else in the audience who had concerns about the bill? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson-Ropes, do the hospitals know about this increased fee, and are they supporting it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I have had no contact at all from any party that's pushing back at all. In fact, in our discussion preparing for today's testimony, the lobbyists and other organizations have said they have not been contacted by anyone with any concerns, and the testimony in the House had no opposition.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, just one other concern, Senator Erickson-Ropes, and that is that this could affect the medical assistance payments, so be aware of that as your bill heads to the Finance Committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Erickson-Ropes moves Senate File 1512 be recommended pass referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Senator Betzel will take your bill up now. I know yours has another committee stop as well. And we are in a hurry. I know that.
And so I'm going to be very quick, Mr. Chair. And there is a,
we'll
by the way,
this
is the first stop. There's an A2 amendment that I would.
Senator Higgins moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape Senator Betzel wishes. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, this deals with an area. It's a sort of a gap in the civil commitment law that this bill is intended to address. Under civil commitment, there are options short of commitment. For instance, if an individual is willing to continue to work with a treatment plan, you don't need to commit them. There is something called continuances or stays of commitment, where the court finds an individual is in need of commitment but actually doesn't commit to allow the person to go along and complete health care, so you're not actually committed. Separately, there's in the 1980s, there was a Supreme Court decision called Jarvis versus Levine, which gave the courts, which required that there had to be a court hearing before neuroleptic medications can be forcibly admitted to patients under commitment. And part of that actual court order does provide that, or the Supreme Court decision provides that that cannot be part of clinical testing. Now, what happened, there was a sad case that happened that brought this bill to our attention, where a young man in Dakota County was under a stay of commitment, so he was voluntarily working on it, but he was also part of a clinical testing program at the University of Minnesota, and ultimately he committed suicide because apparently controls were not in place on the clinical testing. So there's a concern here about somebody who's mentally ill, volunteering for treatment, but then as part of a clinical program. And so this bill kind of addresses that, where a person who is under a stay of commitment would have to, you know, is normally prohibited from giving consent to participating in a clinical drug program unless, and then page 1, lines 21 through line 31, if a treating psychiatrist testifies or submits that the patient would benefit from a clinical trial, and then as you can see from the language, that there are some controls on there so that if there's going to be a patient who's mentally ill, volunteering for treatment, but is under a clinical test, that we have some safeguards so that the court is actually in the loop there. Basically, Mr. Chair and members, that's the bill.
Thank you. And you have some witnesses who wish to
speak. Well, I believe that some family members who were involved in the matter may be here. Roberta Opine, the state ombudsman, is here. I believe that they would be here to answer questions and so forth, but I realize because of the time crunch, if it's desired to have additional testimony, but I've just summarized what the bill actually does. And the bill would have to go to the Judiciary Committee if it passes
right.
From this committee.
Is that okay? If you need to speak to the bill, fine, but otherwise, if you just available for questions, that would be preferable. Are there questions from the committee? If not, Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 431, as amended, be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lori, your bill has another committee stop, too.
Mr. Chair and members, we've got Senate File 1890 and I appreciate your indulgence. I've got the A1 author's amendment with, and I'd like to incorporate a quick change. I can read that. I've given it to council, so they have it already written. But on page 10, line 31 of the A1 amendment, I'd like to incorporate strike everything after care. On page 10, line 32, strike everything before the period and insert practitioner, comma, other than a veterinarian, comma, as defined in section 151.01, subdivision 23. So that it's really addressing the definition of prescriber. So prescriber means a licensed health care practitioner other than a veterinarian as described in section 151, et cetera. And I did give this to
okay, and that's on line councils. Page 10, line 31
and 32.
31.
And so I'd like to incorporate that into my A1 author's amendment to get the bill in shape.
Okay, and we have not adopted the amendment yet.
Right.
Okay. Senator Lori moves to amend the bill with the delete all A1 amendment with those two changes incorporated on line 31 and 32 of page 10. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Federal Stimulus Act passed the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act, the HITECH Act, for investments in hospital and clinic e-technology. And we need to put our statutes and our existing investments in shape to take the best advantage of these federal opportunities available. And so that's what this bill is intended to do. And for the sake of time, I'm just going to turn it over to Jim Golden from the Department of Health to step us through it quickly.
Mr.
And
Golden,
describe
please,
how it'll position
please go
us.
Through the bill for us quickly. Yes.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the director of the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. This bill really has four sections. The first section is taking the work that we have been doing in Minnesota since 2004 around e-health through the e-health advisory committee and really making sure that it is using the same types of terminology as well as has consistent duties with what will be required under the federal stimulus package. The federal stimulus package has $2 billion that will be available for state and federal efforts to promote the use of health information technologies. Focusing on the major sections, subdivision 1A at lines 117, just update our state definitions to be consistent with the definitions that are in the federal law. The next major section is subdivision 4 on line 328. What that is doing is taking a look at what we are doing here in the state and requiring the Commissioner of Health and the eHealth Advisory Committee to make sure that its activities are aligned with the federal activities. It would include such things as updating our statewide plan for electronic health records to be consistent with the federal strategic plan for those activities. We would be required to coordinate state and regional activities for technical assistance that we are providing to healthcare providers. We would also have responsibility for reviewing, commenting, and assessing the appropriateness of national standards activities for Minnesota providers. And this is very similar to activities that we have been doing, but it expands the scope of the activities and makes sure that we are doing the activities that will be required to get the maximum federal incentive money under Medicare and Medicaid under the stimulus package. It also requires in that section for the department to apply for a grant to fund some of these activities. The governor's budget had $350,000 to serve as a match for those activities. The next major section is subdivision 5, which is a data collection section. One of the goals of the federal stimulus, because there's $31 billion flowing through this, they really want to make sure that people are putting in electronic health records that actually improve care, not just are another tool or piece of technology in the clinics. All of the grants, all of the activities require some assessment as to are you using an electronic health record, are you using functionality that improves patient care, For the incentive programs, particularly for Medicaid, there will be a requirement to get some business data about payer mix, what percentage of a provider's business is Medicare, Medicaid, commercial, and uninsured, because that will go into the calculation of both the Medicare and Medicaid incentives. All of the data that would be collected here, none of the data that is collected here is individual patient data. Individual patient data at an identified level or a de-identified level. This is all about providers, clinics, and hospitals and their use of health information technologies. The next major section of the bill is Section 2. This takes an existing loan program that was put into place in the 2007 session and funded with state dollars, and it aligns it to maximize our opportunity for federal pull-down in a loan program. In the governor's supplemental budget, he allocated $4 million for this loan program. There's a 1-to-5 pull-down, which would allow us to have up to $24 million for a loan program. What this does is it specifies what the loans can be used for, which was very consistent with what we had previously, but we did match it to the federal language. We have authority consistent with federal language to get private contributions to the loan fund that would be able to be used. We also changed the eligibility of the loans to ensure that as many healthcare providers as possible are eligible for these loans. Capital investment is one of the primary barriers to providers putting these into place. We also change from a first-come, first-serve for the loans, we change it to a prioritized support list. And the priorities are critical access hospitals, federally qualified health centers, entities that serve the uninsured, underinsured, and medically underserved, and then primary care clinics. The rest are technical changes to the loan program, which are just consistent with the requirements of the loan application that will be required under the federal requirements. And then finally, Sections 3 and 4 of the bill are just the updating of the e-prescribing standards that are the same as Senator Dahl's bill that was in front of the committee previously. And that was just put in here because of the e-prescribing component in the stimulus package as well.
Thank you. Mr. Golden, I think the federal government really stretching to find acronyms high tech.
It's very creative.
They're very creative.
That's just a coincidence. They just named it.
It just happens to be the name they chose. If discussion from members of the committee, is there anybody in the audience with concerns about the bill? There are two people wish to speak briefly about the bill.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Golden, the data that you're going to collect, I know you said it's not going to get down, drilled down to a certain level. There's no reason why the department would ever sell any of this information, is there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, there's no reason that the department would sell this information. The only real sharing that we would anticipate of this data would be possibly with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, both to determine provider eligibility for Medicaid as well as Medicare. We want to make sure that Medicare has as accurate data as possible so that as many of our Medicare providers, healthcare providers, would be eligible for the Medicare incentive. But we would not be selling the data, no.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? If not,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brettner-Sullivan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Golden, Dr. Golden, I believe, right? Are these loans suitable for? I've had calls from people in my district who are providers, small clinics, really small clinics, you know, two or three person, and it might be a psychologist's office. And they now are caught in having to submit their billing electronically, because we've required that, and they don't have the capability of doing that. Would these loans be suitable for something like that? Although I'm not sure that they're equipped to be able to put in $3 million systems and pay it back.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, That wouldn't be the primary function of this loan. The primary function would be to have an electronic health record that would be either a certified or a qualified electronic health record. That having been said, there are some packages which also have practice management systems that would include a billing component that start to tie together the clinical as well as the administrative side. So from that standpoint, to the degree they had a product that was more integrated and included both the clinical as well as a practice management, that would be appropriate. With regard to the size of the provider, under the state program, we had a provider that got the maximum of $1.5 million. We also had a chiropractor who met all of the requirements and got $41,000. So we would have a variety of loans anticipated.
Thank you. The two witnesses with concerns, please come forward as quickly as you can. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And we're not opposed to electronic medical records, but we are opposed to limiting an individual's options to stay off of a national medical data system. The HITECH Act specifically says that each of us will have a single electronic medical record, which means all our data will be online. Our ability to have a second fresh opinion from somebody who doesn't know all of our data will not be available. What this language does is to essentially put us, Minnesota, into the national health data system without any opportunity for individuals to give their consent or to opt out. And it is important what Mr. Golden mentioned about Medicare, because this whole thing about getting onto the system is going to be a financial penalty for anyone who, any physician who chooses to protect their patient's privacy and give them a single, their own record and not have it onto the national healthcare system or national health data system. And then the last thing that I would point out, and I'll point out in line 3.10, where it talks about a qualified electronic health record, that means to harmonize it with the national system. And on line 3.22, that means to harmonize it with the HITECH system of reporting on doctors, but not only reporting on doctors and having somebody else decide whether or not they're good, but also essentially using the medical record of everybody in this country for comparative effectiveness research so that everybody becomes part of this research project without their consent. And as to Senator Dahl's question about identifiable information, while that may be true about the providers and their use of the data, what this really means is that identifiable data will be available widespread, because HIPAA does not protect the privacy of the medical record. It is a data disclosure rule allowing, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, 600,000 entities plus their business associates to have access to medical records without the consent of patients. So we would prefer it if this legislature would instead protect the rights of patients to stay out of the national healthcare system rather than mandating that they go in, which is what this does.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Golden, could you explain to us whether you could go on to Google at some point and type in Linda Higgins electronic medical record and have anything come up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, no, you could not do that. Both state and federal privacy law would prohibit your data being put out in that way.
Mr. Chair, I just get a little, concerned, I guess, when people keep talking about putting people's medical records up on the Internet. It's not going to be up on the Internet. I mean, I heard one of the presidential candidates talk about that this last legislative or last election cycle. And, you know, I don't know what somebody thinks is going to happen out there in the world, but it isn't going to be that you can just go find everybody's electronic records. And we need to have a little common sense and stop the hysteria on this.
Mr. Chair.
I think that doesn't do it. And I'd like to make the point that we are going to judiciary next, where these data practices issues are really the jurisdiction of. So we'll get there. But there isn't any sharing of personal information between providers here. The data can't be identified or de-identified. There's not personal data sharing in this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Brace, very briefly.
Mr. Chair, It's not about putting it on the internet. It's about putting it online. That's what interoperable means, that it's available to everyone who through HIPAA has access, which is lots and lots and lots of people and not just the physician. The HIPAA definition of healthcare operations is 306 words long, and even the words in it are not defined. So I think it's very clear that what this bill does is to make that possible for all of those entities to have access because HIPAA does not protect it.
Thank you. We have one more witness, and Dr. Golden, in the meantime.
Mr. Chair, committee members, just to clarify one thing, the intent of electronic health records would be that my providers are able to share my records with my permission. There is absolutely nothing in this bill that would change any of the federal or state privacy or consent requirements. The same consent requirements that are required to share data between providers today in Minnesota would be here with this bill. So this changes none of those.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Flaherty, and I'm a planning director for Department of Human Services. And I just like to go on record by saying that we believe there was a tiny blip in communications. We didn't receive the placeholder language for this 1890 until late last night. And we did have issue with that, so we came today to discuss that and found the delete all was in place and this had been replaced. And the state Medicaid director has not had an opportunity to review this language. So we just want to be on record.
You want to be record that you haven't had a chance to review yet.
Yes.
And if the bill is going to Judiciary Committee?
It is.
Let's indeed make sure that they have a chance to review it before. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
I just like to say for the record that I think that it's the duty of the departments to share information and not show up at a hearing to testify against a department bill.
That's quite a surprise to me. That's the first.
So, thank you. Further discussion of the bill. If not, Senator Lurie moves Senate File 1890 as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye. No.
Motion prevails. Senator Scheid is here. Senator Lurie, if you wanted to make your motion, we...
I don't know the file. For
Mr. Chair, I thought we had to be out of here at 3. I thought we had to be out of here at 3, and it's 3:05.
I was told we did, too, and they said that the Education Committee is...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we reconsider the motion by which Senate File 1478 was not recommended to pass a couple of weeks ago.
Mr. Chair, I actually had another. I was going to ask you if you thought this was wise, considering that we were supposed to be done at 2:45. I've got another committee. I've noticed that there's a few folks who have already left. We are after the time that the committee is supposed to end, and now we are going to be taking up a rather controversial bill, and I think this is really inappropriate that we do this at 3:05.
Mr. Chair, Senate File hasn't been heard yet either.
That's correct. We have not heard one of the bills on the agenda, and members of the committee are allowed to bring up bills that we have voted down, and in this one they did give not a lot of notice, but they gave notice a couple hours ago they intended to do it. We would be able to take this up on Monday and perhaps get it to floor session on Monday night or Tuesday if they're processing bills, which they may be, and still get it out on Tuesday. But Senator Lurie has made the motion now. If you oppose the motion, you can do so. But, I mean, he has the right to make the motion.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to go on record that I really think this is inappropriate. This is indicative of what has been going on at the Senate this year. This at 3:05, well after the time for this committee has expired, and folks have already left, and we have other committees that we have to attend. We are pulling a bill up that is controversial, and I don't know how much time you plan on spending on this, but it seems like a very poor time to do this.
Senator Fischbach, I have another committee as well, and I'm sensitive to that. Senator Lurie, you have a choice. We apparently could have it brought up on, we are having a hearing on Monday, and we could hear it then. And assuming they hold floor session open to process bills, it has to be through the Judiciary Committee as well, and they Judiciary meets on Tuesdays?
Yes.
Somebody who's on it? They meet on Tuesdays. So we could do it then if you would prefer to do it then instead of right now. But you have the, you're the one who makes the motion. So.
My motion stands.
You do wish to pursue the motion. If so, any further discussion on that motion to reconsider? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chairs in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hands. One, two, three, four, five. Those opposed? One, two, three, four. 5-4 motion. The motion does prevail, and the bill is in front of us. Is Senator Shy here? Senator Lynch, you had an amendment, you said.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shy, I'd like to offer the A4 amendment.
Senator Lynch, why don't you describe it while it's being distributed?
Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment is reflective of the 2008 Conference Committee report on this issue. Very simply, this bill, this language provides or addresses three critical purposes: the testing of infants, the quality assurance, and the newborn screening test, and the public health related research. The bill further provides parents with three opt-out options. Parents will have the opportunity to opt out of the test, opt out of the storage, opt out of the research, or a combination thereof. And again, members, this bill was reflective of that 2008 Conference Committee report, which had the support of Commissioner of Health.
Senator Lynch, is this the same as that report? Or are you saying reflective is it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, the language contained in this is identical to that of the Conference Committee report as it was adopted.
Senator Scheid, it's
Mr.
your
Chairman,
bill.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't know you were going to do this today. I'm sorry I wasn't here earlier. I was up on another issue in a committee on which I serve, and I'm appreciative of the fact. I mean, this is a very important subject, and it's very important to the department and to the health of Minnesota public. And I prefer Senator Lynch's language. I listened to the discussion the evening, I don't know, a few weeks ago when you considered the bill, and am fine to have the bill in the shape. I'm pleased.
Okay. Further discussion. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, could Senator Lynch tell us what, after the Conference Committee report, what then happened to the bill last, or I guess you said this was 08?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, we went to Conference Committee. We had the full support of the entire bipartisan Conference Committee. At the conclusion of the Conference Committee's work, I recall asking the department to come forward and comment on the work of the Conference Committee, and they were pleased with our work and supported the report of the Conference Committee. And as members will recall, that this bill, which came to me directly from the agency, was then vetoed by the governor.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, is there some reason we have that that won't have to understand that that won't happen again, or what's changed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, I think that's kind of the big looming question over us. I can only tell you that no one was more surprised last year when this bill was vetoed than the Senate author. I had worked with the agency every step along the way, and I had no reason to believe, after I left that conference committee, that this bill would not be signed into law. And so it's difficult for me to try to speculate how the governor's office might react to any legislation in this area that might come forward to them.
Senator Hand.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, I appreciate your bringing your amendment forward. It really is not remarkably different from the bill we had, Senator Scheid's bill, except that Senator Scheid did have some provisions that put some limitations on the ability of the department to keep genetic data. But the primary problems are still there. Most important in my mind is that we are setting aside the informed consent law that seems to be entirely applicable to this process, number one. It doesn't distinguish between the actual testing, which has a good purpose and which I think most people would not object to making it an opt-out procedure for the testing. The heart of the objection is with the retention of the data that the department has been doing illegally for some period of time and that they propose to continue to do without any consent. And I think that's a problem. Even under the language that you point out that gives parents an opportunity to, if you look on page 2 and bottom of the page, lines 26 to 35, section 3, it talks about what happens if a parent elects to opt out, even if they go through this and do it. It says that the department has to follow the procedures in section 144.128. And what section 144.128 says that the department has to comply with a destruction request within 45 days. So even if you request and say, I want this specimen destroyed, the department has got 45 days in which to do it. Also confused by the last line that says a written neglection exempts an infant from the requirements of this section and section 144. So it exempts an infant from all the requirements of 144, which would suggest that it doesn't have to be destroyed at all. I think this is unclear, and I think that this is fundamentally the problem with this bill, is that the conflation of the testing and the screening when they are two different things. Of the requirement that is in law right now that says you have to have informed consent to do testing. And we're making an exception here for no reason that we've had the department here before, conversation. They gave no reason why we should set aside informed consent for testing. So members, I look at this as simply a way to, I guess, endorse a procedure that the department has been doing illegally for some time after the fact, and we shouldn't do it. And as I said before, if this informed consent law doesn't apply to this, then it doesn't apply to anything, and it's meaningless. So I would urge us to vote against this.
Senator Lynch, then Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scheid. Just for the record, I've been in quite a bit of conversation with the Department of Health on this issue, and in none of my conversations did I walk away with knowledge that there was illegal activity taking place. And, Mr. Chair, we could get into, once again, the discussion on opt-in versus opt-out. I would just suggest that is that's a lengthy discussion, and I'm not sure what direction you want to go with this at this time.
We'll let members make their comments, and then we'll deal with the bill. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to comment again that I think this is really poor form. I think that this session, we've already listened to this bill. This committee defeated it. I think this is just poor form when we have another item on the agenda. It's quarter after the hour, if not later, and I'd like to adjourn the meeting. I'd like to make a motion.
I don't know if that's a debatable motion or not, so we'll assume it's not. A motion to adjourn has been made. On all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
She made it back to the table.
I did make it back. We got state and local running. I'm okay. I'm here now.
Okay, Senator, further discussion on the amendment, let's put it that way. Further discussion on the Lynch A4 amendment. If not all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill as amended for Senator Shy be referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, could I have a roll call vote on that?
You can have a roll call vote on that. Is there further discussion on the motion? Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lynch, can you just point out the key differences here between the two with your amendment from the previous bill as Senator Shy presented it and what the amendment does?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, I think that I can best explain that by suggesting that in the original language in the Senator Scheid's bill, the intent was to keep those blood spots for a set given period of time, and that was 2 years. Senator Dahl, I think one of the marked differences that's not spelled out is the difference between the Scheid's original language and the A4 amendment is that today in Minnesota we have one of the strongest newborn screening programs in this country. And the A4 amendment will keep us at that level. And with all due respect, the language that was original in the bill before us would move Minnesota from leading to mediocre. We would be going from the top to about right in the middle across the states. Senator Dahl, I don't think that's the direction that the Department of Health in the state of Minnesota wishes to go.
Mr. Chair, by myself, just Senator Lynch. So at this point, you're saying that before it was limited to 24 months, now we can retain them for longer than 24 months?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, parents will have the option to have their children tested. They will have optioned in terms of how long they wish to have those blood spots retained for, and they will also have option in terms of the utilization, any research components involved thereof, or a combination of those. Lots of options available for parents. But in Senator Scheid's original language, there was the intent was to retain the blood spots for a period of 2 years unless the parent or guardian would opt out of that. And that poses some serious concerns for many entities involved in this discussion. And it frankly dilutes our program.
Further discussion, Senator Hand and Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just, Senator Dahl, and I was in the committee, we had testimony from the department where they said that they have been collecting this data without the informed consent of the people, the parents, for years. In fact, that is the very reason why paragraph B is in the bill, because they have not got legal authority to do what they have been doing. So, Senator Lynch, I don't know what you would call that. I call that illegal. They may not call it illegal. They clearly didn't think it was, or they didn't interpret the informed consent law to apply to what they were doing, but I read the informed consent law, and it seems to me to apply directly to this kind of procedure. The point is that I think we should distinguish. There is nothing, we should not think of the screening to be the same as the retention and the testing. And these things have been conflated for purposes of this bill. Fine, let's have the screening. Let's have an opt-out for the screening. But if you want to keep this material for any period of time beyond the screening, you ought to have informed consent. And this law says, no, you don't. You don't need that. We're going to keep it forever and do whatever we want with it and test it and do whatever we need to do or think we need to do, and we don't need anybody's informed consent. And so my question is, if that's the case, why do we have an informed consent law at all, and why are we making an exception in this case? And those questions have never been answered. So, again, this is not a good thing to do. We shouldn't do it. We should separate the testing from the screening. Let the screening go forward with the opt-out, but this ought to have informed consent to retain these data.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I think the issue here is that there can be a child born with a congenital disorder for which we have no treatment today. But 5 years from now, there likely would be treatment. And so, as Senator Lynch has said, a parent can opt to have their records destroyed or not to have the test done at all. But under the language that was in Senator Scheid's original bill, every parent that has records at the Department of Health would have to notify the Department of Health that they wanted those records retained. And that would be a huge burden both on the department and on parents who may not wish to have those destroyed, but they may not even know that they would be likely to be destroyed. And so the point is that 2 years is too short a time, because oftentimes either something isn't discovered within the two-year period or a treatment is not available, but it is on the horizon, and it likely will be available in the future. And that material is needed to be retained by the Department of Health for longer than 2 years.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
And maybe Senator Berglund said this. And for Senator Dahl, they may opt out in any case and
yes.
not have this stored.
Right. Any parent can say they don't want the test done, or they want it done, but they don't want the records kept,
right.
or they want the records kept, but they only want them kept for a certain period of time. But the way the bill was otherwise written, everybody's child that has any records at the Department of Health would have to notify the department that they wanted those records retained if they wanted them retained for longer than 2 years. So I think this amendment is a great improvement to the original bill.
Senator Berglund moves Senate File 1478 as amended. We recommend pass referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Secretary will take the roll.
Senator Marty.
Yes.
Senator Berglund.
Yes.
Senator Dahl.
Yes.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Yes.
Senator Fischbach.
No.
Senator Hahn.
No.
Senator Higgins. Senator Johnson.
No.
Senator Coring. Senator Lurie.
Yes.
Senator Lynch.
Yes.
Senator Prittner Solon.
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray.
Yes.
By an 8-3 margin, the motion does prevail. You're on Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Lynch, you have some witnesses who I believe are still here. If you think we can go through the bill quickly, we will do it. I want to warn members that Monday is the last of our meetings before deadline, and we could meet in the evening, but we want you to be aware that the meeting may run long. If members would prefer to go into the evening, we can make that decision, but I want to alert people ahead of time that we might go long then.
Mr. Chair, how much longer do you intend to go?
Senator Lynch, how long is your testimony?
We're just revising that right
five
now.
Minutes. Less than 5 minutes.
Less than five.
Because we are now, and I'm saying it for the record, Mr. Chair, we are now at 3:25, which is a very long time over our scheduled meeting time, and we are starting a new bill.
I understand that. And we did run long, and we will be possibly running long on Monday unless members would prefer an evening meeting. We will go as quick as we can. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to offer the A3 author's amendment.
Senator Lynch moves the A3 author's amendment, which is, I believe, in the packets. That's in place of the A1. Mm-hmm. Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, very briefly, this bill simply adds fetal alcohol spectrum disorder to the list of related conditions currently defined in statute.
Let me be clear, as I was clear with the advocates and stakeholder groups when they came to me with this, and we have had much, much discussion and work on this, on these four words. But this does nothing to provide for coverage or provide assistance. This simply highlights that a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is can be considered as one related condition. There's a list of criteria in the bill, lines 1.1 and downward. All of those criteria need to be met in addition to the identification of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will ask my testifiers to make some very brief comments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joanna Bears. I work for the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. And first, I want to thank Senator Lynch for her outstanding leadership on this bill and Craig for all his work. MOFAS is the only statewide source for information and resource and support on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. As many as 8,500 Minnesota babies are born every year with brain damage caused by prenatal alcohol exposure. MOFAS has dedicated itself to for the prevention, intervention, and support of individuals and families affected by FASD, which is the leading known preventable cause of cognitive, social, and behavioral disabilities. The inclusion of FASD into Statute 252.27 would give FASD credibility to Minnesota. This inclusion would not increase the number of people qualifying. They will still have to meet all the criteria in the related conditions part. Therefore, it will not increase the dollars spent. There is no opposition to this bill, and DHS has become supportive of this bill. So why are we doing this? We're doing this because it'll give social workers and psychologists and other agencies a second look at FASD and show it's a real disability. With that, I'll move on to our second testifier, which is Dr. Jeff Wozniak.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Wozniak.
Thank you. I will be brief. I'll speak every other word on my sheet. I'm Jeff Wozniak. I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist at the University of Minnesota. I work clinically with children with FASD, and I do research in this area. And my role is to just explain to you that fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is a serious life-altering developmental disability with brain involvement. We see this when we do research involving MRIs of the brain in these children. The diagnosis of FASD is a very rigorous process. Typically, a psychologist is involved doing an extensive battery of cognitive tests, oftentimes 4 to 5 hours. A pediatrician sees these children for a formal physical evaluation, evaluating the growth and facial characteristics, and then there's a formal set of diagnostic criteria for FASD. So in conclusion, FASD is a very real developmental disability that often meets the criteria for related conditions. The diagnosis has and will continue to require a very comprehensive formal evaluation by professionals. And the proposed change to the statute will not alter that in that requirement and thus will not increase the eligibility. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Wozniak. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jean Kitola, and I'm a parent of an 18-year-old adopted son who has FASD, and I'm also a board member for the Minnesota Organization for Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. I appreciate this opportunity to be able to present this information to you today. We were denied DD services based on strictly on IQ. However, we used government resources in what I feel was a very non-productive way, and it always begs the question if my son, who has brain damage from prenatal exposure to alcohol, had had services earlier like a personal care attendant or respite care, could we have averted the cost of the many services that we used? And here is a list of what we have used since 2007. Police intervention over a dozen times for truancy and aggression, crisis intervention hotline services with social workers coming to our home, juvenile detention, several appearances in juvenile court, judges, court administrative assistants, public defenders, prosecuting attorneys, victim liaison because of assault, probation officers, which there are three types. There's the investigative, the one that oversees the case, and also restitution officer. a shelter placement, and then there was coordination of special ed departments between school systems for IEPs, assignment of a temporary social worker until a court order is determined, assignment of a permanent social worker, residential treatment facility at approximately $275 a day that was court ordered, assessment by a DD social worker, funding for a homebound teacher of 60 hours to bridge the gap between residential treatment and home placement, more coordination of a special ed department between school systems for his IEP when his home district didn't support his disability. He is now in a foster group home, which is state-funded at approximately $275 a day. This took an assessment by a SMRT team. He has MA assistant. He has the assignment of a permanent caseworker, and his probation officer is still with him. We do not receive unemployment benefits, welfare, and I hope to God we never have to use the jail or prison system. I truly believe that early interventions could have helped my son, and my hope is that by adding FASD to the related conditions definition, that it will at least open the door for more in-depth discussions between caseworkers and families so that the full scope of the issues surrounding FASD, which is a developmental disability, are taken into consideration and go beyond the assessment of a person's IQ. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cotola. You went through a lot of issues very quickly. I'm sorry to hear it does take so much, and we, you know, I understand that's the reason for the bill. Senator Lynch, further comments? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak with concerns about the bill? Any questions from the committee? If not, Senator Lynch moves that Senate File 501, as amended, be recommended to pass and goes to the Committee on Finance?
No, it can go to the floor.
Go to the floor. You saved yourself a stop. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, the meeting of the business of the committee is finished. And as I mentioned, next Monday, one other thing, on Friday, we are encouraging, the Commissioner of Health is coming, and we're doing a 50-minute video of a California thing on, it's called Unnatural Conditions on Racial and Other Disparities in Health. And it's a powerful thing. The commissioner and others have strongly encouraged people to come. We will provide popcorn, so it sounds fun. But we're treating this as a regular committee, other than we will not be convening and so on. But we do want people to be there if they can. We've invited the Finance Division and the House Budget and Policy Committees as well. So we hope people can come to that on 11:30 Friday in room 318. And we are providing popcorn, yes. Anything to get people there. With that, the meeting is adjourned. I wasn't real keen on it. I was told your bill is passed in the House, so it's Senator Berglund. She says there's things she can use in there that she could, and I have a feeling she will take whatever she wants to take anyway. I wasn't real keen on the bill, but I have a feeling she's going to find things in it she likes. Yes, she sent a letter. I don't know if you saw that. She sent us a letter saying, well, I really hope you'll hear this bill. And I have a feeling, I mean, to me it looked like some of the things in there would, from fiscal note perspective, increase costs, others would cut costs. Right, and they would, I'm sure they'll get that. And I have a feeling she may pick the things that she thinks saves money and not pick the things she thinks. Right. I think you save money, at least short term. I have my doubts about longer term, but
Right. No, I understand. No.
They're going to see, you know, the birthing coach, or they're going to challenge the contact with the doctor.
Oh, yeah.
Senator Murphy's going to testify before.
Do you guys need more testifying?
We need more.
I can testify on anything. I like the mics are still on.